Hey there, listeners. Need a new gig in the writing world? Have you considered becoming a book coach but never known how to get started or been able to envision exactly what that might look like for you? Author Accelerator can help. Sign up at bookcoaches.com to get a free mini course on what book coaching is, who makes a good book coach, and how you can make money helping writers soar.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delatonia, and this is the Hashtag M Writing Podcast, the weekly podcast about writing all the things. Fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I am the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation.
Woo!
It's out in the world. Yay! And you can find my writing, including a recent excerpt from The Addiction Inoculation, at the New York Times. There's some stuff at Washington Post. It's out there, guys. I'm just so happy.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my new one is called Bombshells.
Woo!
You can find me wherever ebooks are sold.
And I am KJ Delatonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, as well as the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor and lead writer of the Motherlode column at the New York Times, and right now just cranking away on more and more and more fiction. So that's where I'm going.
I got to tell you, every time I get to the end of a nonfiction project, I'm like, this would be so much easier if everything was imaginary. Because then I don't have to worry about, we were joking about the fact that I got an email from a reader who was concerned that I made something up in the New York Times when I said I was picking huckleberries with my son, and huckleberries do not grow in Vermont. So then I had to spend like an hour researching that, but it would be so much easier if that was an imaginary
scene. You know what?
No, you didn't matter. Because you were picking huckleberries. Like, you didn't have to second guess yourself.
No,
you were there picking the huckleberries.
No, I'm sorry.
I know, but I did. What if I misidentified them as blueberries or something?
Like, even if your whole book is made up, people will still yell at you. I have this scene in a book called Overnight Sensation when the hockey team is stuck in Seattle because it snowed. And I got a lengthy email about how that was impossible. They never have a blizzard in Seattle. And she didn't like something else about the book as well, but something factual. And then I swear to God, they had a blizzard a month later. It made like national news everywhere. And I just
totally
laughed
her fault.
My butt off because she caused it. I believe this.
Take that, doubters.
Right?
Take
joyfully
that.
Zipping along through a witchy thriller, The Fifth Petal. I mentioned it in last week's episode, and I did get a little caught up at a moment when, in theory, someone dug up three graves in a small New England town and then reburied the coffins and then covered them up with new sod without anyone noticing them. But I was like, you know what? But I don't care.
No.
I'm not going to write them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to write the author.
But that's
and I'm
okay.
Assuming
yeah.
She is not listening.
Right.
She is very successful. And it was a wonderful book. Go read it. Ignore that particular moment in which you're kind of like, but you know what? Didn't care. Still super fun. So come on, people. It doesn't matter if it snows and there are huckleberries. As long as it's not too much.
I just thought it was really interesting that he didn't just like comment, because if he'd commented, I wouldn't have read it because I don't read the comments. But he actually sought out my contact information in order to send me the email, which I found entertaining.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me even a little bit.
All right, well, this is our questions and answers episode part two. And if your question was, do huckleberries grow in Vermont? We've covered that.
They
and
do.
And if your question was, will your readers question you whether huckleberries grow in Vermont or whether it snows in Seattle? We've covered that too. So, hey, we got, two down.
Well, and it also led to a nice bonding experience with a group I belong to of Vermont foragers. And we all shared our experience picking huckleberries in Vermont. So that was kind of lovely. So where are we going to start
So we would, I think Serena and I would both have advise you not to engage with the person, but did
I
you?
Did because he had an ulterior motive for writing the, when you write a book about substance abuse, often the question that is being asked is not the question that is being asked. And that's why I engaged with
him.
And it has ended up to be a nice communication. So
excellent.
Plus, right. You know, if that I'm not reading sense. The comments, if I'm not reading the comments, I don't have to engage with any of that stuff. And if the most I have to do is inform someone that huckleberries do, in fact, grow in Vermont, then that's fine with me. It was entertaining.
Yeah, that's a victory.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right. Well, Jess, you're going to do the first question because we've got a juicy one.
Okay. Yes. So we have a couple. Both of the questions I'm going to answer today are actually both really juicy, but I'm going to start with actually the thornier one, which is, how do you handle it when non-writing family members and friends ask for help getting into writing? And I'm actually going to expand this question out a little bit because there's that question, because everyone seems to believe that they have a book in them, and maybe they do. Maybe they have the thing that they write. Everyone has a story, that's for sure. We know that everybody has stories to tell, but whether or not that turns into a book is a different question. But I'm actually going to also expand it to, how do you handle it when people ask you to read their stuff and give you feedback? Because I think for me, that's the thornier question. That's the more challenging one. So I actually, having this podcast has been very helpful because I now can actually say we have this whole podcast that we've been doing for 4 years and we talk about this all the time. We talk about pitching, we talk about querying, and then they'll look at me and they'll say, what is pitching and what is querying? And I'm like, we answer those questions. And so I have a couple of podcast episodes that I tend to refer people to from early on where we talk about like getting an agent and stuff like that. And that's really helpful, actually. So yay us to have the forethought. Well, and I did the same thing with Gift of Failure. There's really like 10 questions I get all the time. So I made little videos about those specific questions. So now when I get a question that's answered already, all I have to do is do this auto reply that has the links to those particular videos. So it's been really great. So that's my first move is, here are some podcast episodes that you can listen to, because this is a long answer in an email, especially how do I get an agent and stuff like that. For me, when the question comes down about, will you read this thing? Especially when it's someone I love enough or that I respect enough to give a really thought out answer to, I always have to say, what is your goal for me to read this? Is my goal to pass down judgment on whether I think this is good enough to be published? Or is my goal here, you know, how am I doing with dialogue? So for example, I had a former student who is a writer actually give me his novel to read. And I was really excited because I've read his other work. And I've read the novel. And what's interesting about this is it's absolutely not my cup of tea in terms of genre. It's fantasy, really heavy fantasy. And that's just not my genre. So I was able to say, look, this isn't a genre that I usually connect with. But I'm really looking forward to reading it because I adore you. But what are your specific goals? Do you want me to call out typos? Do you want me to call out, you know, is there something you're looking for in my reading of this? And then I was able to respond to that. And the nice thing about that is I'm always going, no matter what the thing is, I'm going to find something positive to say, whether that's, you know, I think this is promising. I really liked this character. I really connected with this scene. In fact, in the novel that I read just recently, I had issues with the beginning, but felt like he eased into it towards the middle. So I mentioned that. There are also times when people have handed me things that I think are better addressed with a therapist that I, and we've talked about this, like when maybe you should see a therapist instead of turning it into a book right away. And I have said, I think this is a topic that really needs to be talked out thoroughly before you commit it to words that someone else will read. So there's a couple of different ways I go with it, but I have ducked out. For people that I don't know very well, I just say, look, I have 6 books I need to be reading right now to blurb anyway, so I just can't read one more thing right now. So I am able to say no to things as well. But if it's someone I love and trust, I am going to find, number one, find something positive to say about it, establish the parameters for why I'm reading, and give feedback eventually. And I often will say, I may not get to this right away, but I will get back to you. And what do you guys do? We don't talk about this as much with, I tend to do it, I think, more often than you do, KJ.
Honestly, I don't get this question very often. I think that I am scary, and that is totally fine with me, because I really don't.
You also weren't hundreds of kids' writing teacher growing up. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a different situation. So obviously when I was an editor, and I was, that was a totally, put that aside. So I pretty rarely get it except from people that I am close enough to where I am going to, you know, at least give them something of myself. So there's that. And I try the same thing. Great advice about right. What do you want? Do you want me to read this and tell you it's good? Because that's one thing. Do you want me to help you get it published? That I can't do.
Right.
And I won't do. Do you want me to read it and tell you how you could improve it? Are you ready for that? Because I'm really blunt. Yeah. And mostly I tend to ease people towards mm-hmm. the book coaches
yeah.
at Author
I think that's
Accelerator,
a great resource too. Yeah.
Are yeah. wonderful. If it's, you know, if it's an 800 page essay, then, and you're my mother's best friend, then I'm going to help you.
I'm assuming you mean 800 word essay as opposed to
800 word. It's an 800 page essay. I can help you.
My first advice is.
My first suggestion.
I get asked for help a lot, and I am not nearly as helpful as either one of you potentially, because it does really matter who asks.
Yeah.
And I am asked by strangers all the time for help, which is really difficult. And I have seen lots of my colleagues over time be accused of copying things.
Yeah.
So I am never reading a stranger's yeah. novel for like critique or advice. I'm never doing that because I don't want to put myself in the position of engaging, especially in my genre. We're all fishing in the same pond anyway.
Right.
So right. it's really hard for me to say yes, but in a heavily trafficked genre, there's always a lot of groups around. Like, I know where I can send people, you know, various Facebook groups mm-hmm. that discuss writing romance novels and things like that. But for me to pick up someone else's, a stranger's work is just not going to happen.
Yeah, I should have said, I don't even typically answer. I think I also don't even necessarily see, because I'm not great at looking. If I don't know who you are, you're probably not going to see your email unless you...
Yeah,
unless you know enough about me to get it to me, which is yeah. it's not that hard. But yeah, I typically just don't even answer if it's a total stranger.
I get a lot of I do get a lot of strangers. I actually didn't answer that angle on the question. I do get a lot of strangers asking me to look at their work, and I just can't look at all of it. I just can't. And I think there's this added wrinkle with the internet and, you know, people that we quote know, but we don't actually know. And it, especially since, and this sounds weird, but, you know, when I listen to an author read a book to me online and I'm listening to an audiobook, I do feel like I get to know that person. And so now I am sympathetic to the fact that when people come up to me and they say, oh, I feel like I know you so well because you're in my car with me, you're in my head with me. And so how well do I know David Sedaris? Well, I feel like I know David Sedaris really, really well, but I do not know David Sedaris. I've talked with David Sedaris once or twice and that's it. So I have some sympathy for that, and I have some sympathy for the fact that people, it's really hard to get your work read by people who can help, and people have been very, very helpful to me. So I've just had to get to the point where, unless something jumps out at me and says, oh, this is something that for my own interest would be really, really cool. Also, I've also come to realize that it is so expensive to send books out for no reason. Like when I have said yes to books that I feel like I know I'm not going to read, I feel so guilty because often they'll show up by express mail the next day. And I know that costs like $30 and I am not going to read that book. And the publisher has now just spent $30 to mail out a book to me. And I always feel really bad about that. So I've learned that if my first instinct is I'm not going to read that, then I say I just can't. And I apologize, but I just can't. I would spend all my time reading strangers' books if that were the case. So.
One more thing. As we were discussing this, an email popped into my inbox, and it's from David Cochran, who is a wonderful leader of teaching people how to do stuff. And it's how to self-publish a book in 10 steps. And it addresses all these wonderful things. So sometimes there really is a resource you can pack people off to. That would be even much more lucid than what I might have to say.
Right.
Yeah, I love sending people to other podcasts, to things like that. It's all out there. If you didn't bother to look, that can be a little annoying. But again, you know, if you're a close relative, it's fine. I would ask you to help me with the thing that, you know, if you're a real estate salesperson, I would ask you if that's it. If the person was a realtor and you would ask them for advice on your house sale and expect them to respond to you for free, then you're going to help them here. So, well, this is a good segue, if we're ready, into another question that we got, which is, how do you craft the perfect opening for a personal essay? Because that's the kind of thing that somebody might send me a personal essay and say, you know, what do you think? So typically, the way to craft the perfect opening for a personal essay is to write the essay twice as long as what you need and then cut off the first half. That's one way to do it. Another excellent way to do it is to write your first draft, then look at the first paragraph, move that to the top, and then revise the entire thing. Those are the two most common editorial acts I take in terms of helping someone to open up an essay.
Do you mean move the last paragraph to the top?
Oh yeah, is that what I said? Sorry. Yes. Write the whole thing, grab that last paragraph, shove it up to the top, and then see what you have to do to make it work. Those work a lot of the time. And the reason for that is that in a personal essay, our instinct is to bury the lead because it's a surprise. Our instinct is to bury the thing that we learned because we want to take the reader on the journey to it. And yeah, that is fine under some circumstances, but most of the time in arenas where personal essays are published broadly to the wide world, that reader wants to know, why am I going to read this? And so you got to give them that in the first paragraph. So you have to spoil. The first paragraph is basically...
Yeah, I think I think often about I gave this analogy just recently to an op-ed project essay I was working on with someone. And I said, you know how annoyed people get when they go to find that recipe for really chewy chocolate chip cookies and they have to read all about the author's experience with their grandmother and it takes you 3 minutes to just scroll to the bottom?
And with ads interspersed throughout the entire thing.
This is the essay version of that. Let's get rid of all the stuff about your grandmother and let's get to the ingredients for these cookies and basically make sure you go pre-your oven first. Let's get there faster. But I love that advice about if you're really looking for your lead, it's probably in your last paragraph. So go grab that. Yeah.
Probably.
All right. So this actually segues well, but another question we got this week was how to find reasonably priced solid editors.
This is perfect. It really is.
So yeah, so I would say there are a lot of editors in the world and, you know, maybe I'm just in a mood, you guys, but this is going to be another cynical little bit here. Anyone can call himself an editor and charge money. It's not like you can claim to be a podiatrist and then just, you know, become one. But in editors, that's actually true. So, and also editing can have any price. At the very cheap end, you can pay somebody about a half a cent a word. And at the top of the pay scale, it's like 2 cents a word. And, you know, it's so an editor who's going to do a thorough copy edit of your work or more is going to be in that range. When I went looking for editors who could take on work for the world that I'm publishing this year, I quickly got 100 responses. And so if you, again, I would send you to a forum for people who are doing exactly what you're doing. Let's say you're writing a thriller. And if you say, hey, where can I find an editor? My first question to you will be, what kind of book is it? And why are you hiring an editor? For which stage of your production here? So if that person is going to submit to agents, I would question the need to pay an editor first, unless this person was very specific about, you know, maybe they don't write cleanly or they just really want to pay that money. Okay, well, you might do that. But most people who are looking for editing help are going to publish the work themselves, which is fine. But then you want to make sure you have the editing from somebody who is used to your own genre. So if they don't edit thrillers, then you don't want that person, no matter how good they are. So once you identify a list of people who could potentially become your editor, you still have a little work to do. It's pretty imperative that you send the first 2 to 3 pages and ask for a sample edit. If you don't do that, then you really don't have any idea of that person's skill level or their detail level or whether they just fit your book. And any editor who stands to make $1,000 or $2,000 off of this job should really be prepared to provide a couple of pages of a sample edit. Like, and you can find people who will say, I never have to do that. And it's possible that they're right, that people who have asked them to take on a job before have been too timid to ask for this or didn't know that they should, but you really should, because not all editors are as skilled. The two editors that I prefer to use will cite, you know, manuals of style when they want to change something about the way that I've, you know, done something that they really know. They have, it's not just by feel. Like you can have somebody who's an English teacher who still is working by feel. You know, they have maybe great instincts, but if you're going to pay someone to edit your work, they should have the rules like right there and be ready to defend any changes they've made. And it's surprisingly hard to find that. So you really need to do some due diligence.
And again, with the analogies, you would not hire a decorator whose work you have not seen. You would not hire a website builder whose websites you have not seen. So you should be able to look at someone else's editing.
I'm going to disagree with the part where you don't have to hire an editor if you're going for an agent. I don't think you want a copy editor at that point, but depending on how confident you are in the story that you have created, and maybe also on what you're basing that confidence on, you might want to work with a developmental editor before you start trying to get an agent. It just might, and maybe you throw out some, you know, maybe you do some agent querying first, and if you're not getting success, if you're not getting, or if mostly if people are asking for a full, which, just to walk back through the agent querying process, you send a query and maybe the first 5 pages, whatever the agent wants, and then they request, you know, something. If they're requesting fulls and then you're not getting, like, you're just getting a lot of no's, that might be a moment when you want to back off and look at a developmental editor. Good developmental editors can also be had for about 2 cents a word. That person might not work with you like on an ongoing book coachy basis, but they would give you a read and, you know, flag things. So if you're open to that kind of response, I don't know. I think it's probably a worthy investment. It kind of depends on what your goals are, but I would say you could do it.
Yeah. I also want to take this moment to refer people, go look at the website for ASJA, the Association of Journalists and Authors, and the Authors Guild, and various other sort of groups that that's what they're there for. I mean, ASJA at one point was giving, people were making their own book proposals public so that people could go look at them and understand how to put together a proposal, that kind of thing. And I bet you there is a listing of authors, of editors and copy editors and all that sort of thing over there. I know that they've come up in the Authors Guild emails I've been getting recently. So
I would say that asking around is your best bet. Yeah. Because mm-hmm. if you find somebody that someone else works with, then you have a reason to have some confidence.
Yep. Yep. All right. You want to move on to the next question?
Yeah.
I get questions about research all the time. And so someone asked very specifically, how do we research and read for research? And this is a great question. I happen to have, caveat, this is the way I do it. So first of all, I'm a big fan of going online and finding the obvious first books. And I have to say, I tend to buy as many of my books as possible at independent booksellers. But I will say that the if you like this, you'll also like that tool at Amazon can be really helpful. So, for example, if I'm looking at my book wall right now. So if I have a certain book that is like a big obvious, book in a given subject matter, and then underneath there'll be like people who bought this also bought that, and I use that as a way to sort of weed through, and then I put everything on a big wish list so that I at least have a list of books that I'm thinking about. So that helps me get started with paper books. I tend to research using paper simply because of my intense love for sticky tabs. And as I mentioned in the past, I have a system for my sticky tabs. I buy these booklets. They're always in our annual gifts for writers because I buy a ton of them. They're by a company called Semicolon. That's Semicolon with a K. And it has, I think, 12 different colors of sticky tabs. And I pick 3 for each book that I read. And it doesn't matter what 3, it's just 3 colors. And one color means, ooh, juicy quote you're going to want to make sure you use. And another one is, come back to this. This looks interesting. And then there's one for, ooh, emergency, alert, use this or research this. And that's sort of the one I use least because it's the one that means do not forget to look at this before you hand in your final draft. So all of my books have a variety of 3 different colors sticking out all over the place. And warning, the reason I like the semicolon sticky tabs is that cats cannot pull them out as easily. other varieties of sticky tabs roll up and fall out of books really easily or off of journal papers, things like that. Semicolon has a stickier stick to it. So I find that it's harder for my cats to rip them out of the books and harder for them to just sort of fall off if it gets humid. So these are the things that are important, people. We have to think about adhesion because I have a drawer full of substandard sticky tabs that I'm never going to use because they don't stick well to my books. And then that's a disaster because you found something important and you can't go back to it. I also do a lot of underlining because then when I go to the page that I've sticky tabbed, I can go quickly to the thing. So my books are written, there's writing all over the books that I read in the margins. Sometimes I'll put the letter Q on a sticky tab so I indicate that this is an important question I want to come back to. So I have all my books. Then I also have, for research, I use Google Scholar. And what I like to do when it comes to academic research is look up what's called a meta study or a metadata, which tends to be, so for example, like Martin Seligman at University of Pennsylvania did a study a couple of years ago, a big meta study of learned helplessness. And so what a meta study does is look at the body of research on a given topic. And what's so great about that is there'll be an entire paragraph that says, and the association between X and Y was assessed originally by blah, blah, blah. And you end up with a really great baseline place to start looking at research. So they can be really helpful if you're researching an essay for a journal. They can be really helpful if you're going, for example, with addiction inoculation. If I want to know, what is this thing called inoculation theory? I can go to a big meta study on that just to get my start, because that's not the place where you want to finish, but it's definitely the place you want to start. And I use I'm not going to get too in the weeds, but I do use a big content resource manager, like a big database. There's Bookends, there's EndNotes, there's a bajillion different ones. And what's really great is you can just drag your resources into that as you're looking them up. So you have a ginormous bibliography of all the potential resources that you're going to use for your book. And then I tend to download them as PDFs where possible so that I have them in a folder. So that's just sort of a starting place. And then I organize my, I use those magazine boxes to standing, you know, the vertical magazine boxes to organize my research, which is not ideal because papers will flop over and end up shaped like an S when you, when they flop down to the bottom and then you end up with wrinkly, but it's the best I've got so far. So that's how I handle the book part. I handle the paper research part with the boxes and Google Scholar. And then when it comes to just internet research, I've heard people say, you know, that they love Evernote for that. I don't have a great system yet. So if anyone wants to go to the Am Writing Facebook group and give me a system to use for, you know, that article in Time Magazine or that article in the New York Times or that article wherever, for organizing that stuff, I tend to print it as a PDF to my computer and then stick it in a folder, but I don't have a great resource. I never really committed to Evernote. I know some people love it, but I haven't ever gotten a good grip on it. So anyway, that's my basic system, and that's mine. Maybe not the one that works for you, but that's how it works for me. Also, my office is, my bookshelves in my office are arranged by subject and subject within the subject. So no, I don't do alphabetical order or nonfiction and fiction. It all goes in the same place.
It's supposed to be rainbow order, Jess.
I know. I don't know what I would do. I mean, they're pretty, but oh my gosh, how would you find anything? I don't understand it.
Do you research? I don't understand. Do you research it for fiction, Serena?
Yeah, but not like Jess does, because it ultimately doesn't matter right. Where I found a source in that. So there you go.
Yeah,
yeah.
I will grab a few memoirs, especially if like I love to do that. I mean, what can we say about my process? I've only two books in, and one's not published. So, but yeah, if my main character is a farmer, I will, you know, pull out some farm memoirs, because yay, I'm happy to do that. Right now, I'm thinking about trying something in a different genre. So I'm reading a bunch of stuff in a different genre, and also reading some nonfiction on the stuff around that genre. And I'm having a really good time with that. I like to get, you can often find some really cool things by using Amazon's used book feature, which I think is supporting, you know, at least it's supporting independent businesses. So if there's stuff that, you know, you're not going to order a 20-year-old, I know there's some stuff that your independent bookstore is going to be like, what? But you can find it with the used bookstore search.
Used bookstores,
If I could do that used on bookstores A Books, I would, but they don't exist anymore because Amazon killed them.
I found a used bookstore in some town I was in last year, and it had the most amazing selection of books that I was just not going to find anywhere else, and I ended up filling up my suitcase. It was fantastic. I do want to mention one quick research thing, that when you're researching something as, for example, as big as The Addiction Inoculation that has this huge bibliography, and you're going to be working, for example, I don't know, on excerpts that you may want to place in magazines and newspapers, just be really thorough with where you got various sources. Make sure that your notes are good, because this week I've been working on excerpts and editing excerpts, and the editor will say, well, where did you get this assertion? Where on earth did that come from? And there were a few where I was like, oh my gosh, please let this be in my notes. And if something was not in my notes, then I now have to re-research something that I already researched for the book 2 years ago. And so just keep good notes. That's just learn from me. Keep good notes. All right. KJ, you're up.
I'm up.
Yeah. So, good question.
Yeah, we have a great question. My favorite, actually. How do I become Liz Gilbert?
I was hoping that was the one you were going to ask.
So let me give you the 10-step outline. Yeah. Okay. You're herewith following a list of the people whom you cannot become. Elizabeth Gilbert, David Sedaris,
Glennon Doyle.
Yeah, Glennon Doyle. Yeah, no. You are either born that person or you are not born that person. Sorry. And if you're born that person, you're not listening. You're already out there doing your very, very unique thing, which draws people in like flies. And congratulations. It's amazing, and we need these people in the world. So I often say Davis Sedaris has done more disservices to essay writers than anyone else I can name, because he is able to make his points by demonstrating through dialogue and things that happen to the people in the essay. No one else can. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Or very, very yeah. few. So, you know, people send you these essays that are all like this dialogue they had with their crazy father. And you're like, yeah, that's sorry. No. Liz Gilbert, I mean, just wow. You know, she's really probably a better example of someone who was struck by lightning and made something of it. Yeah, I guess my other comment might be that I don't know that you really want to be Liz Gilbert or David Sedaris or Glennon Doyle. I think those are really complicated human beings to be. One of my favorite lines of Liz Gilbert's is at some point she says, you know, I'm really not a person who likes a lot of drama. And then you want to just back up and take a look at her personal history. And I think she might be wrong. So, yeah. You know, I would say, if you're saying, how can I become Liz Gilbert? And I know that you are kidding, but look to your own strengths and what you really want for your whole life, not just your writing, and build that.
Well, and I think, you know, as for example, Glennon, I think Glennon is as surprised as anyone by what happened to Glennon. I think Glennon started doing something that really worked for her as a human being, which was to have a place to tell her stories and to be honest with herself. And people resonated with that. But you can't predict what people are going to resonate with on a very deep level. And so trying to emulate someone else's connection with people is going to be, by its nature, disingenuous. It's just not, you know, the thing that people connect with about her is the fact that she tells the truth. And that's great. And that's fantastic. And I think as writers, a lot of us do need to be telling the truth more often. But, you know, that level of honesty can also be a very difficult thing to carry around with you. And to be that person for other people is very, very difficult. I mean, I've watched her do it. I watched her at signings. I watched her sit at a, and this is public, people know about this. She even talked about it once. I was speaking at the same conference that she was, and we were sitting next to each other at a table, and a woman came over to her and essentially wanted to sit at her feet and just be in her presence, like as if we're talking about, you know, John the Baptist or something. And she just wanted to be near her. And I said to Glennon, I said, how can you spend your time, you know, sort of being this for all these people? And her answer was, I can't do it very often. It's just exhausting. So emulating the connection that someone else has with people, it's, I don't think that's really possible for us to do. Yeah. Anyway.
So, you know,
find your own thing.
Well, do the crazy thing that everyone says not to do. And if that resonates, yay. But yep. Also remember that there are many different ways of being a successful writer in the world. And, you know, some of them are Liz Gilbert and Glennon Doyle, and mm-hmm. some of them mm-hmm. are, you know, much more reserved people that you don't even see on social media. And some of them are people you haven't even heard of who are still beloved by their readers. So, you know, let's just appreciate that we have Liz Gilbert.
Right. Do your own thing, do it really well, and make sure it is feeding you. Because if you are doing that thing, you are going to have to live with that thing, and it better be feeding you.
So we had one more great question that I just wanted to answer, which really quickly, which was, how do you find the best online writing classes? And the answer to how do you find them is you ask your friends and you listen to the ones that you hear multiple times. But I also pulled out some that I have either taken or heard great things about, or, you know, can genuinely recommend without reservation. And here they are. Grub Street, great writing classes there. They're all online now. The New School has good stuff. Maybe I'm not recommending that one without reservation because you might want to look at the instructors. But those are, you know, sort of legit places that are delivering what they promise. Writer's Digest University, I think, is a good place. Gotham Writers, Writer's Studio. Something that I've been a part of and I can definitely recommend is called UPod Academy. That's a great one for freelancers. It's kind of the very rare instructional organization that is geared towards getting your pieces into online newspapers and print newspapers and print magazines. It's very much about freelancing. And if you are a personal essayist, I would recommend you look up Sue Shapiro. She is also an extremely successful essay writing coach. She will help you find the essays that are in you and help you find places to place them. She's pretty amazing. And lastly, I recommend Rachel Herron. She sort of offers, they're more like writing cohorts that move along. So if you're kind of looking for a writing group, that would be a great place to do that. And if you're already writing and just feeling like you could do this thing better and faster, then you might want to look to our last week's episode guest, Becca Syme, who has the Better Faster Academy, which I also recommend. So I'm going to list all of those in the show notes, but those are, there are some really great places to meet up, get some community, and further your craft. And by the way, I did this stuff. Like when I was first getting started, I've got two friends that I met in an online fiction writing class that I'm still close to. Do it. It's great. And it was online even long before COVID. So enroll yourself in something.
Don't underestimate the in-person writing groups, too. If you're able to find just the right one, my mother-in-law has been part of two groups, actually. Maybe it's just down to one now, but a group of people that she's been friends with for ages, and they know each other, they get each other, and they really help each other with their work. And that's been a really great source of support for her over the years. So if you're lucky enough to find a really great in-person writing group in your area, then, you know, go for that too.
Absolutely.
And look locally. Look locally. There's, I know, for example, in Vermont, we have lots and lots of writing affinity groups that you can, if you just Google them, they'll pop up. So I highly recommend that as well.
All right. Well, these have been some great questions.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break and come back with what, if anything, we've been reading.
If you like hashtag #amwriting, and I know you do because you're here listening, you will love Writing Class Radio. Writing Class Radio airs true personal stories and gives you tips on how to write your own stories. We're also open to airing and discussing your personal essay. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Find Writing Class Radio wherever you find your podcasts.
All right. Jess, read anything good lately?
I'm reading something fantastic right now. I found out on Twitter, Liz Lenz was someone that we interviewed a long time ago, and I adore her. I still subscribe to her Substack, and she was raving about Elon Green's book, Last Call, and I am a fan of true crime, and Last Call is fantastic. I absolutely love it. It is Last Call, a true story of love, lust, and murder in queer New York. And it's essentially, it's a story about some brutal crimes targeting gay men. And also just for me, of course, I love to learn about just a world I'm not a part of and that sort of world of gay men in New York. It's been a fascinating read. It's been a really interesting history lesson, and it's a great true crime book. So that's by Elon Green, E-L-O-N Green. He's also a wonderful Twitter follow, so you might want to check him out for that as well. But yeah, definitely check out Last Call if you're a fan of true crime.
All right, and I just finished Superhost by Kate Russo. This is a fun book, and it's different. It's got a male protagonist, which is kind of unusual. Not really. I mean, it didn't used to be, but I don't know. It's a little bit of a departure for me, I guess. Her protagonist is a host, an Airbnb host, not necessarily willingly. His life as a very famous artist has gone downhill. He's divorced. And so it's him interacting with the people that stay in his very beautiful London townhouse and also sort of trying to pull his life back together. It's really good. It's really thoughtful. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed all of the perspectives. I wouldn't call it a page turner, you know? It's quiet, but in a good way.
Good. Excellent. Well, when things aren't page turners, those are often my, like, I have a couple books going and I can dip in and out, and I like having non-page turners as my books I can dip in and out of.
Yeah, it's like that. You're not going to be laying there at night going, oh my God, I can't put this down. But that doesn't mean you won't want to pick it up.
Yeah.
All right. This was a great episode. If y'all have more questions, you can reply to the show notes email if you get it. And if you don't, you can sign up for it at amwritingpodcast.com. You can head into our Facebook group and ask anything there. That would be a great way to ask. And yeah, those are the good ways to get us some more questions so we can do another fun question and answers episode. And if we've got some that you asked that we didn't get to, and there are a few, we'll do this again, or, you know, we might be planning to answer them in a different form.
And the fun thing is that if you ask the questions there, you get lots and lots of interested and engaged writers who will give you all kinds of other cool answers, so you can get more answers than just ours, because, you know, we're just three people with three people's experiences.
Yes.
All right. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.